Hello and welcome to the Do One Better podcast in philanthropy, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Alberto Aligi from London. Please click that subscribe button and follow us if you're not already doing so, and do leave us a rating and a review. It helps others to find the show as well. Today, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome onto the show Lynette Bell, president of the Truist Foundation. And we're going to be looking at the work they're doing primarily around strengthening small businesses and developing career pathways for economic mobility. They're co-creating programs, they're building the body of evidence, and they are convening national nonprofit organizations, the public sector, and the corporate space in order to drive forward positive systemic change. And so, without further ado, Lynette, a big heartfelt welcome onto the Do One Better podcast today.
Thank you, Alberto, for the opportunity. I'm so excited.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure. You're out there in New Orleans. I'm here in the UK. So we do have a bit of time difference. And I am a little bit envious of where you are because I haven't been to that city in a long time. But I have very fond memories as well. You're the president of the Truist Foundation. Why don't we start there? What's the foundation all about?
Well, the Truist Foundation is the philanthropic arm of Truist Financial Corp. We're the sixth largest bank in the United States. And so we are also a purpose-driven financial institution. And what that really means is that we are committed to ensuring that our communities have an equal opportunity to thrive. And the bank is very much focused on driving purpose. And so we decided our purpose, mission, and value was to inspire and build better lives and communities. And so one way that we live out that purpose through the foundation is to ensure that we're investing in communities to help them create greater opportunity for everyone. You know, by partnering directly with nonprofits that support wealth building for underserved communities, the Truist Foundation really helps to be an innovator and make kind of that meaningful difference in the lives of those that we serve. And so in 2020, the two big financial institutions in the Southeast merged to form Truist Financial Corp. And the foundation really had a kind of rebirth or a new birth at that time. And we went on this really intentional journey about how do we really invest in our communities using grant making as the platform. And so we landed, Alberto, on two distinct pillars based on the research, right? We pulled a lot of data and research in based on the markets that we cover, which are Southeast, Northeast, and a little bit in the Midwest. What's happening in those markets and where can we play a significant role? And so we took this data and came up with these two strategic investment pillars. The first thing was strengthening small businesses. When the pandemic rolled in and we merged right as the pandemic was happening, small businesses really had to recalibrate their models. And a lot of them didn't have the equipment to make those changes or shifts to be resilient. So we said that's really where we should find space to invest in. The second area was we realized that wealth trajectory is so different for everyone. But a lot of individuals, particularly in the South and Southeast, where the highest level of unemployment and the highest level of poverty exists, did not have the skill set to transfer their current skills as jobs became obsolete up to a new job. So we really focused on building career pathways to economic mobility, which simply means where those organizations, the nonprofits that work with individuals to help them upskill and reskill, transferring learned skills into this new sector. And then helping them get placed to earn a living wage. So we kind of blew up our model from the past and created something totally new in 2020. And for 4 years now, we've been on this journey, really leaning into these two strategic investment pillars.
Fascinating stuff. And now you've been with the foundation for several years, and you've been with the financial institution in its various incarnations for many years.
For many years. I don't tell out the real number aloud. I've been at the institution over 30 years. I like to tell people I've done everything at the bank except make a loan, which, you know, you think that's the easiest thing to do. But there's so many very particular jobs in the different sectors of the financial services industry that I've done quite a few of them. And I have been at the same company my entire career. And so it's been exciting to, for sure. But the most fun I've had at work, quite frankly, is, you know, we drive for real systemic change was working in the foundation and leading the foundation, getting that opportunity to not only co-create ideas and solutions, but, you know, using data to help drive and influence the strategy moving forward. So we were very, very tactical on using that data to help build the strategy for the foundation. So for me, this is the most fun I've had at work.
Excellent. Excellent. You know, they do say if you love what you're doing, you never have to work a day in your life.
Yeah.
But it's great that you've been involved in various capacities for decades, because it means you know the space intimately well, you know the markets intimately well, and ultimately, you know those folks who you're trying to help. And when you're talking about systemic change, you're well versed with it as well. For those listeners who maybe are international or just simply don't quite know, I know the South isn't one of, like you mentioned, not the most affluent part of the U.S. And in terms of philanthropic giving, also actually quite a small percentage of recipients based there. Give us a little bit of insight into that market, that space, and some of the dynamics that might be useful for us to know.
Yeah, I will say a large part of our work that we do began being focused in the Southeast. Even though we cover over 24 states in the U.S. with the District of Columbia, the South is one of the kind of fastest population growing areas in the United States. And clearly, it is the top, we have 15 fastest growing cities in the South. However, when we look at population growth coupled with philanthropy and how dollars are invested in the South to address all types of issues, only 3% of philanthropic dollars nationally go into the South. And so, you know, we're based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Though we're based in the South in Charlotte, our reach is far bigger than that. And so we want to really make sure that as we look at data that supports the need to invest higher in the South to help people change their lifestyles and change the way they live for not just themselves, but for future generations, the South really needs support in that manner. And so we're committed to really collaborating and investing in communities to build those better lives that I talked about earlier. We believe that when our communities are thriving, then the bank, of course, thrives. You know, we're the philanthropic arm of the bank, but the bank is, you know, the driver of all of this work. And we get to co-create solutions to address some of those issues that need support in the South. And so one of the things that I want to talk about is that we concentrated on these two pillars, building career pathways to economic mobility. But in the South, the unemployment rate after the pandemic is really still very high, even though the U.S. is talking about, hey, we have reduced unemployment rates and, you know, the GDP is down. But in certain communities, particularly urban versus a rural market, are experiencing a totally different set of economics. And that's why we build programs to help workers navigate to those employment resources. We build capacity for that reskilling, upskilling programs, and strengthening access to programs that really protect workers. So it's important for us to really understand that data fuels the work, but really philanthropy is where the marketplace of ideas gets born. And we believe that that is the only way to tackle some of those systemic issues that exist in communities.
You touched a little bit earlier, you mentioned, you used the phrase co-create, co-creating, and now you're talking about building programs. You've highlighted quite a few times the research, the data. So it seems that you're quite involved in different facets of this puzzle. Give us a bit of visibility into how you operate on the building the programs, whether you're a grant maker, and if so, what that looks like, the co-creation process, your proximity. I know trust-based philanthropy, for instance, is an area that's also on your radar. What does that all look like? It's a broad question, but you'll have to excuse me.
One of the things I will say is we looked at, again, using data to influence a decision around strategy and the investment platform. We actually started working with a very unique opportunity on an initiative called Where It Starts. And we said Where It Starts is really grounded in the belief that building better lives and communities starts by seeing the whole person, and that seeing the whole person is the starting point toward meaningful and intentional change. So we realized we can't do this alone. And so we had a unique opportunity as we thought about how do we create a solution? How do we bring in the right partners who can help drive that impact? And so we created this solution called Where It Starts. And we brought in three national nonprofits that really were experts in the field of helping to build career pathways to that economic mobility or strengthen small businesses in that ecosystem, which is so complex. You know, it's not just about access to capital for small businesses, but it's also about building the ecosystem to address some of the results around technology and technical assistance, again, because the pandemic put the U.S. and I'm sure the world in different capacities, we thought, what a great way to do it. So we committed $23 million last year, bringing in these three national nonprofits to help co-create the solution. So the first signature grantee is Kale. And so Kale is a national nonprofit who helps improve education to career pathways for adult learners. And they are using $15.7 million of the grant to operate a program to call Where It Starts, Build Better Careers. This partnership really creates a pathway into industry where communities of color have been underrepresented, including the financial services industry. We believe that by empowering and equipping those individuals with the resources and the technical tools they need to transition is in education, but it also brings that knowledge base into their life so they can readjust and reskill so they can get into the career they want to see. The second national partner was Living Cities. It's a member collaborative working to close the racial income and wealth gap in the United States. And then the other partner was Main Street America, an organization seeking to advance local community-led economic development. And why that is important is that we realized that when we started on this initiative, when we looked at the data, we picked five cities. So Miami, Atlanta, Charlotte, Nashville, and Memphis. And every one of those cities, the mayors of those cities joined into this solution. So we're bringing in the public sector along with the private sector and the philanthropic sector to help address some of these systemic barriers that exist under these two pillars and drive that solution. So small businesses, as we noted and saw during the pandemic, are the backbone of many local economies. And yet a lot of Black-owned businesses are seven times less likely than white-owned businesses to receive the support they need for starting up their businesses or to get the funding they need. Living Cities and Main Street really are programs help to uplift those entrepreneurs of color, increasing access to capital, providing them the resources and the technical support to overcome those inequities that they often face when starting a small businesses. So that is what we started. And again, these national nonprofits had never even talked to each other. And now we're asking them to come together in a way that creates inclusion, but also tackles inequities under their two pillars that we wanted to support, which was helping people upskill and reskill to the new demand job, and also strengthening small businesses and supporting that ecosystem to help businesses not only be resilient in a disruptive economy, but to understand that they need to project a little further in order to have sustaining power.
Was it difficult convening these national stakeholders? You mentioned, you know, probably had very limited engagement with each other. And in this case, it's not just these three heavyweight national organizations, but also, as you pointed out, mayors from five different cities. You look remarkably refreshed for what I think is probably quite a bit of heavy lifting.
It is a heavy lift, and it is very complex work. And so I love the fact that these nonprofits hadn't worked together before, but they were so open and receptive, because what they realized, well, we don't have to compete for the grant dollars. And we're like, no, we've already set the budget for this based on the conversations we've had with them. We did a lot of back end kind of, you know, research and having conversations and dialogue with them on what are the opportunities to really co-create with you as we think about addressing or tackling specific issues that exist in the Southeast. And they were so open and amenable to it and have gotten together. And the unique thing about this partnership is that we wanted to make sure that we got with proximate leadership on the ground, not swooping in as the big national partner out of New York and DC or California to come to the small Southeast city and say, oh, you don't know what you're doing, but coming in and linking arms, because linkage is important to people who are already doing the work, but we're not seeing any way to advance the work. And so that really is the uniqueness of the partnership. And that's what we want to see in philanthropy, right? Is that no one has to compete for dollars. The dollars are going to be here. Everybody will get their right distribution. But how do we tackle the work so that the assets you bring forward can be linked to mine so that we get the advancement and eliminate the barriers, whether it's on the employment side or placement side or on the business side.
Over the last 4 or 5 years, the pendulum moving in the right direction?
It is moving in the right direction. I will say, depending on the local cities that we're in, four of the five cities advancing really well at a great pace. One city, not so much. And so one of the things that we realized is that there were threads of consistency as far as economies that we, or in demographics that we saw for those cities, which is why we selected them. But then we believe that, oh, one city's got to be just as far advanced as the other. And so what we're realizing is that we got to do a lot of deeper work to build that linkage and partnership with those on the ground. And again, public-private sector work well sometimes, and sometimes they do not. And so that is one of the things that we're trying to continue to push forward so that the other one, other city that's not flipping at the same pace, comes to that level. So yes, a lot of lessons are being learned for us. We're getting insights from our measurement and evaluation of this work because, you know, sometimes we have to take that risk. Is it going to work? We'd love for 100% to say, yes, it's working at 100% and at the same pace. In one city, it's not. It's considerably slower. And again, we're dealing with some additional challenges, but that's what you want to see. Philanthropy is, the grant is the catalyst for the change, but it also has to take the risk with our grant capital to try and make that change happen in a very intentional way. And so that's what we're doing.
What's the headwind? What's the main thing in that particular city where things are proving a little bit challenging? And
yeah.
I notice you haven't mentioned which is that city.
I'm not going to.
Fair enough.
The
okay.
The city mayor calling me. I will say the headwind is the public sector misalignment with the nonprofit sector in that city. The nonprofit sector has been doing a lot of the work, but again, it's not, so we can't solve problems alone in philanthropy. You know, it feels like sometimes we're having a lonely episode of work, but we can't do it alone. And so when some of the barriers of unemployment, you know, skilled learners or skilled opportunities are not being, you know, put into the system to support the community or the population, then there are struggles with that. So the one headwind is that the public sector is not bringing those federal dollars to help address some of those systemic barriers that are existing in this market. And they've been existing there, let me go here, for at least 10 years. And so we're dealing with a decade long level of politics, you know, systemic barriers that have existed. And again, just based on historical references, continue to be a problem. And so we're trying to really undergird that and pull it apart so that we can actually see some different changes.
Interesting. Now, as you would know, and many folks familiar with philanthropy would know as well, with philanthropy is relatively small in terms of the budgets, the resources. Even if you hear of grand names like Gates, those are still small relative to the public sector, relative to the corporate sector as well. And you touched on the word risk and, you know, taking a little bit of looking at a risk capital as well on the philanthropy side. Usually, that's the thing, right? The philanthropists have that risk appetite. They have some evidence underpinning what they want to do, proof of concept, and you hope that the public sector would take note and say, okay, yeah, you've taken the risk, you have the evidence, we can embrace that, we can scale it. Mm-hmm. What's that misalignment? What is it that the public sector is saying, well, you know what? We're just not hopping on board here, just not yet. Is there something that they're skeptical about? Is it there's a need for educating? Is it more of a need for a charm offensive? How would you characterize things?
Yeah, I would characterize it as, you know, not having the right amplification and showing the impact of where the work can provide support, not only to the economy of the city, but, you know, the nonprofit sector that's there have a lot of limitations to your very valid point. You know, in most large cities, you have a couple of large philanthropic private families that are providing dollars into, you know, the community to incent others to join them on the journey. And so the public dollars that need to be joined together with the philanthropic dollars, there's some hesitancy on the part of state government to support it in that way. And so the cities where we're having great success, we got the city, local, you know, we have local state municipalities supporting the work and investing in the nonprofits that were already there, but also bringing additional resources and capital for it. And so that's not happening in the other city. And I think the issue is that they haven't seen impact, to your point, for the last 10 years. So they're like, why invest that way? Why use our federal allocated dollars that way? And so we keep showing them other models and examples from city to city where when you couple those investment dollars together from the public and the private sector, then you have the movement and shift to those measurement or impact numbers that you want to see. And so that's all we can do is continue to educate and build the amplification around why this is important, why it matters.
Yeah. If you and I are sitting around a table in 5 years' time, or say 2030, you know, that year of the Sustainable Development Goals, what does success look like? Where do you want to be? And how do you want to build on the success that you've had so far?
I would say that for the Truist Foundation, I would love for us to, in 5 years, be at a point that, wow, our endowment now is double the size it is today, and that we have opened up the portal a little bit more to trust-based philanthropy, and really talked about looking at sectors that today are small, maybe in numbers. So when we look at nonprofits who are small in size, and again, some of the rigor that we require to provide support of our application process, we have an open application process. I'd love for that to still continue. I'd love for that to be on our mobile platform as well, which don't have that today. It has to be a web-based portal. But I would love for us to have seen that we drove real structured change in an intentional way to eradicate the barriers that exist for those individuals that needed to upskill and reskill, and see that they also advance in a way in their careers that they've changed the wealth trajectory, not only for themselves, but for another generation forward. For small businesses, you know, another economic disruption based on what the research is saying is going to happen. And to see that small businesses have not only the infrastructure to be resilient, but, you know, some of the things around the cloud and AI that's happening, are businesses really in tune with that to be part of some of the tech changes that are happening at such a rapid pace? Small businesses really are so far behind. So what we learned in the pandemic is that we had to provide technological support. And then they had to take their businesses from a face-to-face B2B to one that was backroom function and really go online. And a lot of the businesses did not have the technology to go online and change their platform. And so if they could stay abreast to the change and speed of technology so that when the next disruptor happens, they'll be prepared and ready. That's what I would like to see that happens in 5 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Anyone in particular you'd love to hear from? Is it perhaps a mayor of a small town, or a policymaker, or a governor, or a corporate leader? Who are the sort of stakeholders? And I imagine it's quite a broad range, but who are the sort of stakeholders that you'd really love to connect with, that you could do with some inbound calls from?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that is really kind of unique in this space is that you get to meet other philanthropic nonprofits or endowed foundations or private family foundations. And so the top, you know, 2 to 3 foundations in the country or in the world that are global in their, you know, demonstration of supporting, you know, initiatives that are bigger than where we actually sit, that would be ideal. Getting into where policy changes happen, right? You know, most nonprofits don't have lobbyists. But when we talk about some of the systemic barriers that exist under how do people, you know, upskill or reskill to new jobs or employment, are there some policy advocacy that needs to happen where we lobby for those kind of changes? So maybe getting into some of the policymaking work in a way that advocates at the top of the house, where barriers exist and are very clearly defined, those would be conversations I would like for us to have and really see the whole sector of philanthropy move to, is that advocacy in a way that helps change policy as it's mandated, that affects so many systems that exist across this country on the economic side.
Now, I have to ask you, and you've shed a little bit of light, both in terms of how much fun you're having in your current role and how you've transitioned from pretty much doing every function within the private financial space to where you are now, more on sort of social impact. Tell us a little bit about that transition. What prompted it? What do you recommend to those who are listening who perhaps are in the private space and are considering, you know, in the back of their head, it's percolating, it'd be great to maybe incorporate some sort of social impact into my professional life, professional well-being?
I would say that percolating for me is that, you know, when we talk about being intentional and centering some of this philanthropic work, you know, for those who are wanting to shift to an opportunity, I think, you know, some of the work is really system development work. And so as we have grant capital that we can apply to that, that's where real change happens. And so, you know, look for those organizations that really drive impact. And maybe you think they're too fat, they're too big for me, they're going to have an astronomical fee. Have the dialogue or start the dialogue or conversation so that you can assess and make the decision. I will say one of the other things that we've done, you know, we talked about building those two strategic platforms. And I'm always thinking, how can we innovate in a different way? And so innovation is really key because technology is changing at such a fast pace. The other piece of the pie for us was that we know that, hey, we're going to invest and make grants. That's what we do. We're a foundation. we actually started having a conversation about how can we show and demonstrate the change, that the theory of change that happens in this work. So we started what we call was the Inspire Awards. Again, playing on words in our purpose, mission, and value statement of inspiring and building better lives and communities. And we interviewed all of these organizations, including MIT, Solve, which is a philanthropic arm of MIT, the university here in the US. And they actually work with solution and innovators to come up with and addressing problems globally around the world. MIT Solve is a large entity at the university that supports innovators. And so we put a challenge out a year and a half ago going, how can you support the small business ecosystem away as they try to address inequities or barriers that exist? And we submitted that as part of their platform on MIT Solve's platform. And we had over 160 innovative solutions that came through. We hosted our first annual Inspire Awards. We're getting ready to do our second one literally next week, where we had over 100 plus submissions, again, addressing the question around what technology is needed to support small businesses from a nonprofit standpoint. What are you using as you provide that technical wraparound support to the small business ecosystem? So we had 100 submissions. We reviewed them all. I literally was on the phone yesterday with our 7 finalists. We're having an event in Charlotte on 4/24/24. It will be live stream where we're going to have them present their innovative solutions and platforms on how they support small businesses, providing that technical support for micro to small businesses. And we're so excited to host this again for the second year. And again, it gives us exposure nationally. Even though we're a Southeastern company, it gives us exposure nationally to all of the great thinkers that are out there thinking of solutions around technology to help small businesses. So I would say to your listeners, when you have an opportunity to think bigger and go in a different way, look for the best who's doing that kind of work and try to see if you can join hands with them to create something unique specifically for your entity or organization.
I like that very, very much. Look for the best, see who's doing, go for that. I think that sounds very sensible. Now, before we wrap up, a key takeaway that you'd love for the audience to keep in mind after they finish listening to today's episode?
Yeah, the key takeaway for me is that we live in a time where philanthropy really does fuel the marketplace of ideas. And as this sector continues to try to support what's happening in our communities to help drive that intentional change, I think that is key to this work and it is important. So as you work with other philanthropic organizations or entities, there's always a way to create synergy to build and drive transformative action. And so for us, we really believe that starts with at the community level. Nonprofit leaders know their communities better than we do and have the ability to really be agile and respond to changes as they arise and occur. And so as a corporate philanthropist, we don't often have that flexibility, but working with those organizations that do really helps us to make that impactful difference. You know, on average, corporate philanthropy provides about $20 to $26 billion annually across the United States to nonprofits. The impact we find has the potential to make a huge difference. And of course, there's room always to do more. So I'm proud that at Truist Foundation, we have established a really robust grant-making approach that's innovative, that allows us to take a deep look about how we can impact and really penetrate communities in a way that helps them to expand and thrive. We really do align to our purpose, mission, and value. I know it sounds a little trite, but we do believe that we have to inspire and build better lives and communities in order for us to see real change and to build opportunities for growth and future development of our cities.
Lynette, thank you so very much for joining me and joining us on the Do One Better podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for making the time, for all the passion, the energy that you clearly have for the work you're doing. And I'm already looking forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Alberto, for the opportunity.
Perfect. And that's a wrap. Thanks very much for tuning in. As always, you've been listening to a great chat with Lynette Bell, president of the Truist Foundation. For information about this conversation and more than 250 other interviews and case studies with remarkable leaders in philanthropy, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship, just visit our website at lidji.org. That's lidji.org. Please click that subscribe button and follow us if you're not already doing so, and do leave us a rating and a review. It helps others to find the show as well. Thoroughly enjoyed producing today's episode for you, and I'll catch you this coming Monday.